All right, we're ready for Mark chapter 14, and you did not get a handout of questions for next week. This is our itinerary, and we have anywhere from 16 to 17 weeks in a trimester, depending on how the Sundays or Wednesdays fall. We have 16 chapters. We had 17 weeks. Didn't take us Solomon to figure out we've got an extra week there. So we divided chapter 14. So right here, we're dividing chapter 14 from this week into next week as well. So we're going to go through about verse 31, and then the rest of the chapter we'll deal with next time. So the questions you have on Mark 14 will be the same questions you'll have for next week. So they're extra on the pew. If you didn't get a copy and need that, you can get that after class. So that's where we're going to be for the next 2 weeks. We are in the last section of our outline of the events at Jerusalem, subdividing that. We are in what Stopher labels as the trial section. Now, the trial doesn't begin until later in the chapter. We're not even going to get to the trial today. We'll get to that next week. But in this chapter, we get to the trial. And then his death in chapter 15, and then the resurrection in chapter 16. All right, let's review where we've been. We only have 13 chapters to review, but chapter 1. It is the beginning of the Galilean ministry. Chapter 2, early starts this. I mean, he starts this early. Mark does. It is a conflict with the Pharisees. Chapter 3. Yeah, controversy over the Sabbath healing. More specific of that controversy of chapter 2. Chapter 4, parables. By way of comparison, Matthew took 13 chapters to get to that point. Chapter 5, three miracles giving evidence. Chapter 6, John beheaded, took Matthew 14 chapters to get to that point. Chapter 7, yeah, eating with unwashed hands and more miracles providing evidence. Now, Mark, was driving to a conclusion that's found in this next chapter, chapter 8, and it deals with Peter's confession that he indeed is the Christ, the Son of the living God. Discussion of discipleship, which you see in Matthew 18, giving a comparison. Chapter 9, transfiguration, Matthew 17 by comparison. Chapter 10, divorce and remarriage, you tell me in Matthew 19, yes, parallel. Chapter 11, Matthew 21 by parallel, triumphal entry into Jerusalem. That starts that last week of the life of Christ, Passion Week, as we call it. Chapter 12, parable of the vine dressers and the exchange of questions there. And then last week, chapter 13, destruction of Jerusalem. You tell me the parallels. Matthew 24 and Luke 21. Very good. All right. Here's where we are. We're looking at this calendar each week to see where we are. That triumphal entry began on Sunday, as we mentioned earlier, as we talked about that triumphal entry in chapter 11. And there was the cleansing of the temple on Monday. And then the discussion and the conflict with the Jews happened on Tuesday. We either have no record or there was more teaching, and we'll get to that in Luke 21 and settle that question, or try to. We may not settle that question. Depends on your interpretation of Luke 21, 38. We'll come back to that later. So where are we? If you're making marginal notes, at the beginning of chapter 14, you can either put Thursday or Thursday and Friday, because the chapter covers Thursday and Friday. If you want to be a little more specific, we're on Thursday until we get on over in chapter 14, about verse 53, and we are at Friday. That's where he's arrested, the trial, and his crucifixion on that Friday. Make sense? So what is chapter 14 dealing with as far as the calendar that you have before you? It's on Thursday and Friday. If you want to be more specific, start the chapter at Thursday. Then where we flag the verse division, you might flag that as Friday. All that does is just keep up with a little bit of how soon and quickly things develop. And he's in the tomb on Saturday. And then when we get to chapter 16 in about 3 weeks, then we're on the first day of the week, and he's raised from the dead. Make sense? All right. Now, we're not going to see this anymore today. We'll see that next week. Let's go to chapter 14. What is chapter 14 about? Question one. All right. Whatever you said, you probably hit it, because there's just a bunch of stuff going on in chapter 14. There's the plot, there's the anointing, there's Judas's betrayal, there is part of the trial starting before the Sanhedrin, Peter denies the Lord, praying in the garden. Anything you said, you're probably going to pick something in the chapter. I call it simply the betrayal, the arrest, and the trial. So here's the betrayal. Early on in the chapter, we'll get to that. We'll get to the betrayal. We'll get to the arrest, but we'll talk about or infer some things about the trial. Make sense? When we get through next week, we'll have covered all of that. So here's what we have by way of outline, and we'll be seeing this all throughout. But to be a little more clear, here's where we're going to go today. What's shaded out in gray we'll not get to today, so we're going to cover hopefully through verse 31. That's my goal. That's my target. And then we'll finish the chapter. Making sense? All right. Let's look at a question or two here. Question number two, what was the plot mentioned in verse 1 and 2, and why was it not fulfilled? All right. They're plotting to take him by trickery, and we'll get to that in a moment, and going to kill him, but they're not quite ready just yet because of the people and the fear of the people. So let's talk about this plot to kill, and we will look at some parallel accounts here in just a moment. So let's start with verse 1. After 2 days, and that puts us to that Thursday, because Wednesday is not mentioned here in Mark, maybe in Luke. You know the story behind that. So after 2 days, it was the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Well, you've seen this calendar many times. The outer circle is our calendar of January through December. The inner circle there is the Jewish calendar. And we've talked, as we have been in Exodus, about the month Abib. Remember that? Later, by the post-exile period, it was being called Nisan. And so that's where we have the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread. They're often mentioned together. Sometimes the term Passover encompassed all of that. The Passover was a one-day event, and then the Feast of Unleavened Bread was a seven-day event following that. Make sense? So that started, they killed the Passover on the 15th of Nisan. So you see that little red line right there about midway of Nisan, or the month Abib, if you want to take the Old Testament terminology. So that's a little bit about where we are. Now, we have parallel accounts. We're going to not take time to trace all of that. We have parallel accounts in Matthew and in Luke. And we're only going to mention things as we go along as they may enhance our understanding of that. So let's get verses 1 and 2. We know the time. And the chief priest and the scribes sought how to, they might, I've lost my place here. Yeah, verse 1. The chief priest and the scribes sought how they might take him by trickery and put him to death. But verse 2 says, during the feast they wouldn't do that, lest there be an uproar among the people. Well, there's a couple of things going on here. One is the popularity of Jesus has waned by this point, according to John 6. The multitudes are not following, but there's still a big enough crowd that are gathered in Jerusalem that they're concerned about the effect of all of that. Matthew, I believe it's Matthew. Let's go over to Matthew chapter 26, the parallel account to that. This is not a big deal. Verse 3 mentions that it was, verse 3, the chief priest and the scribes and the elders of the people. This flags another group of people. So here's the chief priest, here's the scribes, and then the elders, those that were revered as the leaders among them, were those that were, in other words, the whole group of the leadership of the Jewish nation is the point, were ready to kill him. They're wanting to get rid of him and kill him and crucify him and do something with him, but the timing just isn't right, they think. All right? Does that make sense? All right. Now let's look at our questions again. Question number three, what did Jesus say in response to the charge that the use of costly oil was a waste? All right, the poor you have always with you, but me you don't always have with you. What else did he say? All right. Right. Good point. Now there's a lot to say about this context. Let's work our way through the verses, and then I want to look at, are there parallel accounts, and are they parallel, and why do they seem to disagree? And so there's much discussion among commentators about those. Some say this is parallel to that, and that's not parallel to this, and contradictions, etc. We'll get through all of that here in just a second. And being in Bethany, verse 3 says, at the house of Simon the leper. Well, that doesn't mean that he was still a leper. It may imply that he had been a leper and has been cured of his leprosy. Not likely. If he has leprosy, are there going to be gathering at his house? But he was known as the Simon who had had leprosy, is what I take that to mean. We'll harmonize that with John a little bit later. And a woman came, and what did she have with her? An alabaster flask of oil of spikenard, very costly, of pure nard, an Indian product. And she broke the flask and poured it on his head. What was the reaction, verse 4? They were indignant. They were angry, saying that this was, why was this wasted? What was it worth, verse 5? A year's wages, 300 denarii. That's the annual wage for a common laborer. Rich people had more. The extremely poor may have less, but the common laborer would make about 300 denarii in a year. So you just think of a common laborer, that what they would make in a year, that's pretty costly. And they criticized her sharply. The footnote will say they scolded her. In other words, they didn't just say, well, this was a waste. She shouldn't have done that. They are rebuking her. You should not have done this at all. And so Jesus' response was, verse 6, leave her alone. Why do you trouble her? She's done a good work for me. Now let's focus at verse 6. He said, the poor you have with you always. Some have deduced from that, some more modernist views have deduced from that, that Jesus is saying ignore the poor. The poor is going to always be poor, just ignore them. That's not what he's saying. What he's saying is, the opportunity to take care and help the poor, you will always have because there's always going to be poor people around. The opportunity to take care of his needs, prepare him for his death, is about to come to an end. So it's soon going to be impossible to anoint him for his death, but it's always going to be possible to take care of the poor. And so let's just suppose, let's just erase that for a moment, and you had some money that you say, I want to do some good with it, and here is an opportunity maybe that you know it's going to spread the gospel with your $1,000 that you have. And you say, but I'd like to help the poor. Okay, but your one-time opportunity maybe is to preach the gospel with that money is about to end. Are you still going to be able to help the poor? Yeah, because there's going to be poor next year and the next year and the next year and the next year and the next year. There's always poor. There's always going to be around. This opportunity may be gone. That's what Jesus is saying here with reference to that. Then go further. Notice, you might underline it, verse 8. Every preacher's got a sermon on this. She has done what she could. No, but she did what she could. Well, all kinds of sermons on that. Have you done what you could? Well, I've done a lot. Well, not have you done what you could? Could you do more? Have you done what you could in worship? Have you done what you could with your family? Have you done what you could? You go on and on and on with the opportunities to spread the gospel. Now, verse 8 says, she has come to prepare me for my burial. And we'll come back to that in a moment. And I'm driving to get through with this and make some comments about the whole thing. Before we get to verse 9, why would this be mentioned here in this context? This may or may not have happened at this point. We'll deal with that as we harmonize with John. So we'll save our comments about that. But why mention it here, whether it fits here chronologically, it's forced here in all three gospel accounts, or three of the gospel accounts. I'm not convinced it's in Luke. Say again?
Is it because it was to be told in memory of her?
All right, that's one thing. Well, one, it's preparing him for his death, and it's in the story of his death. That's one thing. But I'm wondering if it's not mentioned here to contrast her love and her devotion, willing to go to any expense to show her devotion to the Lord, in contrast to who? Judas, who was willing to take a measly sum to betray his Lord. Does that make sense? Think of this annual salary, and in 2022, one translation came out in 22 said that the 30 pieces of silver was equivalent to $200 in our day and time. I'm not sure, but it's a measly amount compared to the annual salary. So here is one giving their full salary for a year, showing their devotion for the Lord, and here's a man taking $200 to get rid of his Lord. Quite a contrast. That may be why it's mentioned in this context. Others have suggested that it gives an explanation, though not described here, but in John, as to why Judas acts like he does. Because he sees this, and he criticizes, and John's account says he criticizes that because he had been... he's a money box holder and he'd been taking out of it. And so I think it'd be better if this was sold and put into the treasury and given, and let me distribute that to the poor. Yeah. And I'll stick a little in my pocket and give to the poor and stick a little more in my pocket. And out of an annual salary, you could steal a good bit. Maybe that's the point of it, but it's partly in preparation for his death. Now let's go to verse 9. What's the point here? Concerning wherever the gospel is preached, this will be spoken of as a memorial to her. Exactly. I'm learning from verse 9, the gospel is going to be preached. It's going to be preached to the world. And as the gospel goes to the world, this account's going with it. Evidence? Got a Bible in your hand, don't you? This is the gospel that's gone to the world. And everywhere your Bible has gone, your New Testament has gone, this story's gone with it. And so we're reading the gospel account in Matthew, we read it in Mark, we read it in John, and every time we read that, we read about this and it's a memorial. So all this criticism you're making of her, her story's going to be told, and so is their criticism going to be told all over the world, and it has been. All right, now let's talk about where this fits and how this harmonizes. Don't lock in on all details here yet, and you're going to understand why as I go through. Notice I flag Luke 6. Let's start there. There was an anointing at the house of Simon, who was a Pharisee. You say, well, that's the same. This is Simon here. Same one. Is it? That woman in Luke 6 was a sinner. You read through the story, and it doesn't seem to harmonize. The 300 denarii is not mentioned there. This woman, again, was a sinner. It's not put in the context of his crucifixion coming up soon. And so I put down here in gray, some think Matthew 26, Mark 14 is parallel to that. I think not. Does that make sense? Because over here in John, it is thought, though probably not the case, that this anointing was at the house of Mary, Martha, and Lazarus. That's what the M, M, and L stand for. Mary, Martha, and Lazarus. Make sense? We'll get to John 12 in just a second. The woman is identified in John's account as being Mary, not a sinner. So that's not the same thing. Now let's flag one more thing. If these are parallel, and I take them to be parallel, that is John, Matthew, and Mark seem to be parallel, then this event did not take place chronologically here, but 6 days earlier. You say, how do you know? Because that's what John says. Make sense? So, gospel writers do not always mention things in chronological order. Sometimes they insert it to make a point. This fits here in the story I'm trying to tell. Does that make sense? All right, let's go over to John 12 and flag a couple of other things. See if we can harmonize. And this may not make any difference to you, but I always feel like I've got to try to harmonize things that seem in disarray. The Bible is never in disarray. It's never in contradiction. But I want to know how to explain some of that. I said, and I should have put this in quotation, at the house of Mary, Martha, and Lazarus, that text doesn't tell us that. What that text tells us is that Jesus had, in John chapter 12, helps me to be in the right text, at John chapter 12, that he came to Bethany, that's where Mary, Martha, and Lazarus were, and they had made supper for him. May have been at their house. The text doesn't say that. So here's part of the discussion. It was at the house of Simon, the leper, according to Mark. Some have wondered if Simon the leper was the father of Mary, Martha, and Lazarus. Any evidence of that? No, but could be. So it could have been in the house of Mary, Martha, and Lazarus, and also in the house of Simon the leper. Or it could have been in the house of Simon the leper and Mary, Martha, and Lazarus were there. There's ways to harmonize that without it being contradictory. So that doesn't tell me that Matthew and Mark are different accounts than John. So I take it, and you may say, I don't think there are, I think there are three accounts. I think that you got Luke and then you got Matthew and Mark together and John is, okay, maybe. But the similarity between John and Matthew and Mark are too common. There's too much similarity there for them not to be the same in my mind. So, and you can reject that if you wish. So what I wanted to flag for you is at verse 4, Mary is mentioned as the woman that did that. And the terminology throughout seems to be somewhat paralleled. Are we making sense on that? Where the question is, I'm convinced that Luke is a separate account. These three are parallel, and there's ways to harmonize those three. Now, you probably can go back and find a video somewhere where I have said John is different from Mark. And you're right. I probably said that at some point. I can change my mind if I want to. All right. Questions, comments? And in a future video, you may find where I say that again. I may change my mind again. Anyway. All right, let's go further now. Let's talk about verses 10 and 11. Judas agrees to betray Jesus. What do you see in verse 10 and 11? All right. Very good. There's two things I want you to take notice of here. One is parallel accounts are going to, let's talk about the money first, and then we'll go back to verse 10. The amount is not given here at verse 11. But parallel accounts to that, that we have in Matthew and in, we have it in Matthew and in Luke, Matthew 26, 14 to 16 in Luke, here suggests it's 30 pieces of silver. So that's the amount of money. And we've already mentioned the measly amount that would be. In 2022, I think it was supposed to be worth 200. Let's even double that, say 400. Let's say even double that and make that 800. That's a measly amount to sell your Lord for. Let's go back to verse 10. What's interesting to me is he initiated this discussion. You see that at verse 11? That Judas, one of the 12, went to the chief priest. to betray him to them. It's not they came and put pressure on. We'll give you money. We'll give you a sizable amount of money. We'll put you in a position of power and influence. We'll do whatever you need. We just need you to betray him. No. He goes to them, I will betray him. What will you give me? And he didn't name his price very high, did he? He could have doubled that, tripled that, and they probably would have paid it. They would steal from people to do this. And so you think about how he initiated that, and then he sets this measly price for what that may be worth. Now, I want to raise a question. Why did he betray Jesus? Ray Pritchard said, Judas remains a mystery wrapped inside a riddle. I think he's right about that. See, on the surface, you would not expect Judas to do this. Now, we're not told yet, reading through Mark's account, this is our cursory study of the gospel of the life of Christ, we haven't been privy to the stealing that he's been doing. So we don't know that. We don't see that. And so what we know about Judas was he was personally chosen by the Lord to be an apostle. He forsook everything, like all the others, to follow him. Been with him for 3.5 years, traveling all over Israel. He saw all the miracles. He heard all the great sermons. He was sent out just like all the others, preaching the gospel. He was chosen to be their treasurer. You don't choose people to be your treasurer if you don't trust them. He was not less experienced than all the rest. It's not like he was a beginner and he doesn't know much of what's going on. You would not expect this of Judas, would you? So what was his reason? Well, chapter 12 of verse 6, you might flag that here in Mark, that the parallel account says he was a thief. He was a thief. So if it was greed, some think it was, he did this for money. Well, number one, he sure didn't ask for much, did he? And when he got through, he didn't have much to show for it. So was that it? I don't know. It's possible that it was for money. It's possible that he was disillusioned. And I think there's something to this. As some have suggested, that he was looking for Jesus to be some kind of political Messiah. Remember, the disciples were dull in their hearing and they didn't understand the nature of the kingdom. Perhaps he was looking for this Messiah that he was working for to overthrow the yoke of Rome. And some wanted to make him king and take him before us. Remember John 6. Judas had to notice that his popularity in the crowds are gone. We flagged that earlier, John 6, 66. And now, instead of throngs of people wanting to make him king, there's opposition and the talk of killing him. This is not what he would have expected. Perhaps he's angry, some have suggested, at the failure, and I put that in quotation, of the mission of Jesus. I thought he was coming to establish a kingdom and large crowds were following him and he's failed. Look, they're about to kill him. He's a miserable failure in the mind, perhaps, of Judas. And it may be that he wants to be on the winning side. Like in a political game. You know, in politics, if you're going in this direction and your guy loses support, I want to be on the winning side. So you jump over here, it may be the opposite, but you want to be on the winning team. Maybe that's it. Could be that he was frightened. Perhaps he saw the handwriting on the wall that if they capture Jesus, then who's next? That may be me. I don't know. He goes to the high priest, maybe to spare his own life, that he ultimately ended up taking. Does that make sense? I don't know what his motive was. You know why I don't know? Bible doesn't tell us. But there's several things. It could have been money. I know he asked for money. Was he frightened? He must have been. Did he misunderstand about the kingdom? Well, all the disciples did early on. He is a puzzle. Yeah. And In John's account of that, in John 12, we may have time to deal with that more in a minute, but when Jesus identifies him, he tells him, the text says, Satan entered him. And I think that just simply means, I don't think that means Satan overtook him to the point he has no control. He allowed Satan and the influences of Satan and the wishes of Satan to control him, just like any one of us. You allow temptation to be stronger than your resistance, and that's the point. His temptation to betray the Lord overpowered his resistance against that. But Jesus said, what you do, do quickly. Gave him one more chance, and he blew it. Interesting. He indeed is a puzzle. All right, Jesus tells, before we get to that, let's get verses 12 to 26. Jesus and his disciples observed the Passover. Now, we're going to subdivide that in three sections, and so let's see if we can get this. Beginning at verse 12, we have, he eats Passover with the disciples, 12 to 17. Verse 12 says, on the first day of unleavened bread, that would be Nisan, that month we've been putting on the calendar, the 15th, mid-month. So that's, it gives you a little timetable for what that may be worth. That's when they killed the Passover lamb. His disciples asked him, where do we go prepare the Passover? And so he sent two of his disciples. Who were they? Peter and John. How do we know? Doesn't say that. Luke 22, verse 8, identifies that as Peter and John. So if you want to flag that in the margin of your text, that was Peter and John. And we see them at the Passover in discussion with each other a little bit later in John's account. So he tells them to do what? You go to the city, and you're going to see somebody. Yeah. Very good. They carry this pitcher of water, and you're going to tell them the teacher, which is obviously a reference to Christ, where is the guest room where we may, and he will take you and show you not just a room, but an upper room that's furnished, and you go make ready for that. So when they go, here's something you might want to underline, verse 16, what'd they find? Just like he had said to them. You learn anything from that? More proof, absolutely. More proof, more evidence that he is divine. Not that you're going to see somebody there and you'll see somebody walking and you'll ask him, oh yeah, I've got a room. You're going to see somebody carrying a pitcher of water and he's going to show you not a room, but an upper room. And not only an upper room, but it's a furnished room. There's a lot of chances for this to be missed if it's not divine working. And so they prepared the Passover, and evening he came with the 12. All right. He announces that one's going to betray him in verses 18 to 21. And so as they ate, he said, and by the way, again, this is not in true chronology always, because the other accounts, I believe it's John puts this, or Luke, I think, puts this at the end of instituting the Lord's Supper, where here it seems to be before that. But be that as it may, what that's worth, you can study that out on your own time. What does he say at verse 18? All right. One of you that's eating with me is going to betray me. And so everyone begins to ask, is it I? Is it me? And so let's flag a couple of parallel here, things. The parallel accounts that you see here, you're going to find in Matthew and also in Luke. But be that as it may, I want to go back and look at Matthew 26 and in verse 25. That Judas asked him, Rabbi, is it I? And Jesus responded specifically, you have said it. Yes, it's you. All right. Now let's go to account over in, let's see, I'm looking at 21. John's account is where I want to go, John 13. Let's go to John's account. John's account gives us a little more insight to that in John 13, starting at verse 21. And as he begins to talk about that, the disciples were perplexed, and John, who was leaning on his bosom, Simon Peter motioned him to ask him, who is this? And so he asked, well, who is it? And he said, the one whom I give a piece of bread. So he dipped a piece of bread, and he gave it to Judas Iscariot. So get the picture. It's not just one of you that's dipping in this, but the one that I give this piece of bread to, and he dips the bread and hands it to. And that must have been when Judas asked, are you talking about me? Yes, I'm talking about you. And that's where Jesus said, what you do, do quickly. And when he received the piece of bread, he immediately went out. He gave him one more chance. I've identified you, I've exposed you, you can turn. And he failed to do that. Questions or comments before we go to the institution of the Lord's Supper? All right, let's get 22 to 26. Get ready to mark a couple of things that we're familiar with the Lord's Supper text. As they were eating the Passover meal, which involved unleavened bread, that he took the bread and he blessed it. You might underline blessed, and I'm going to make a point about that in just a moment. And he broke it and he gave it to them and said, this is my body. Well, he's still in his body. He still has his body. What he means is this is representative of my body. I'll give you more evidence of that in a second. Then he took the cup, and when he had, now what's the next phrase? Given thanks. Might underline that. Draw a line between blessed and given thanks. That's what blessed means. I think sometimes in giving thanks at the table, some guys may have the idea, we're thankful for this cup, or we're thankful for this bread. Bless it to us as we partake of it. He wasn't asking it to be blessed, as we may ask, bless this food to the nourishment of our bodies. Blessing the bread is equivalent to giving thanks for the cup. That's all it means. It means giving thanks. If you come to my table and I say, would you bless the food? What I'm asking you, give thanks for the food. That's all that means. All right, that's all I wanted to make on that point. And then he said, concerning the cup, this is my blood. Now, Catholics talk about transubstantiation, that it literally becomes blood. Some of our own brethren have argued that it doesn't say it represents his blood. He said it is his blood. All right, then are we drinking blood that was forbidden in Acts 15? Forbidden in Leviticus 18, all through the Old Testament, even in New Testament times, Acts 15. Are we literally drinking blood? No. And by the way, he says, this is my blood, while blood was still running through his veins. Now, you might get ready to flag this. He calls it the cup, then he calls it his blood, and then after he refers to it as his blood, what does he call it in verse 25? Fruit of the vine. The cup, the blood, and the fruit of the vine are the same in this context. They're equivalent. They're taking of the cup, this is my blood, and then this is the fruit of the vine. Then, another thing I want you to notice at verse 25 is that this would be partaken in the kingdom. And so, and parallel accounts of Luke 24 says it will not be until then. Now, I mean, we've got about 30 seconds to go, so let's quickly do this and we'll have made our goal of 30. Jesus tells Peter that he will betray him. The quotation that it might, he said, all of you be made to stumble, and he quotes from Zechariah 13:7, if you don't have references to tell where that's from. And Peter responded saying, if all are made to stumble, yet I will not be. And he said, today, even this night, before the rooster crows twice, you'll deny me three times. You might flag verse 72. It happened. And over at 72, flag verse 30 to point back over here. Let me add one more thing. Then he said two more things. Verse 31, if I have to die with you, I will not deny. I'll never do that. I'll never do that. Luke's account, Luke 22, Jesus said, I've prayed for you. Satan has desired you, the disciples, but I've prayed for you, that's specific, you, Peter, that your faith fail not. But when you are converted, your faith's going to fail. The bottom's going to fall out of your faith. And it did. That very night. Make sense? We hadn't seen it happen yet. We just see the prediction of that. So we'll pick up at verse 32 next time And Jesus in the garden, the betrayal, the arrest, the Sanhedrin, Peter then denies the Lord. All that's to come next week. All right, we'll stop right there.